This is writer and game designer Robin D. Laws.
And this is game designer and writer Kenneth Height.
And this is our podcast, Ken and Robin Talk About Stuff.
Bandwidth brought to you by Pelgrain Press.
Stuff we're here to talk about in this episode include...
Building agency into scenarios.
St. Ehrman's Hotel.
The Banana Astonishment.
And the Ostrich Conspiracy.
Big news from Mission Control. If you missed out the first time, don't panic. The wait is over. The Catstronauts board game is finally back in stock at Atlas Games.
That's right. Catstronauts sold out almost immediately on release, but the reprint has officially landed. Now you can finally bring the kitty crew home to your tabletop.
And just in time, too, because things are getting interesting on the International Space Station.
Giant laser pointers in space and a live stream of nose boops? What's not to like? Let's check out how the Catstronauts are doing up there.
Oh man, there goes Waffles the pilot. He's off to see how many kibble bits can achieve orbit around his belly. A pioneer in snackodynamics, that cat.
Careful, Waffles. If the other Catstronauts catch you clogging the air filters with crumbs again, it's back to litter box duty for you.
Look at them working together. Waffles is keeping the station steady. Pom Pom is swatting at fasteners like feather toys. And Major Meowser is... napping on the instructions.
Teamwork at its finest. You can lead this kitty crew yourself in the official Catstronauts board game.
It's a cooperative challenge featuring pawsome art by the comics creator Drew Brockington, and it's perfect for gamers of all ages.
But remember, the first printing disappeared at light speed. Don't let this reprint of Catstronauts slip through your claws.
Secure your copy today at atlas-games.com/catstronauts. That's atlas-games.com/catstronauts. The rattle of dice, the thump of miniatures, the crunch of Doritos, and the benevolent gaze of Peter Frampton coming alive welcome us once more into the gaming hut. And today, once more in the gaming hut, in addition to the dice and the miniatures there on the table, we've got a little old Freitag's Triangle, and we've got a little old Dramatic Mask, because we're borrowing some stuff from the Narrative Hut, because when the Gaming Hut and the Narrative Hut cross over, it's to discuss the nature of scenario writing. And we do this fairly regularly, so we're sort of sifting through our big bag of things that come up in scenario writing. And one of the things that comes up in scenario writing is, I think, broadly speaking, the question of player agency. What exactly can the player's characters do in the adventure? Are they just dropped into the dice rolling tunnel and then they come out the other end all banged up and random? Or do they have more choices? Are there options of things that they can do back to the scenario, changing the game, flipping the situation, rather than just a choice to kill the monster or kill the monster really hard? So the difference is, to put it in, let's say, Robin's terms, as he wrote it down, what happens to the player characters and what the player characters can do? Those are two different things, as I hope I've illustrated. Robin, take it away.
Right. So this is about player agency, but it's about going past the instruction to make sure players have agency to determine how actually you do that in terms of what you're putting on the page. Now that I'm working with a bunch of other writers at Pelgrane to kind of bring other writers up to speed on Gumshoe, I've had a paradox in that this process has confronted me with many great topics to discuss in the show, but I have to wait until many writers present such a topic before discussing it here on the show, because otherwise I'm, you know, throwing somebody under the bus or
just
mentioning
somebody on one specific writer.
But here, everybody has this issue, and it's the easiest fix to keep in mind when you're writing is to think, use your table sense, to use another term we've talked about recently, to imagine what is actually happening at the table and present things in terms of what the players can do and are doing. Because the temptation is, because you do not control what the player characters are going to do, you don't even know who they are, you have no idea what they are, that you will often think, well, I'll just talk about what the bad guys are up to. But that either takes away agency because you are have the player characters basically playing, you know, defense all the time, reacting constantly to what the bad guys are doing, or you're just not necessarily even putting them in the narrative at all and leaving an extra layer of work for the GM to do on the fly, which is, okay, well, here's this villain plan. Okay, what do I have the players do, or what do I give them the opportunity to do? How do I set the scene for them? And that is not on the page. And I think for most adventures that I want to have people present, for example, I want the scenario writer to do a bunch of that work to show the GMs a way to stage things and to put things in front of the GM rather than just, here's the bad guy timeline, you figure it out. And so the first thing to do when you're thinking of any scene is, what is the beginning of the scene from the point of view of the players? What happens? How do they get into it? What's the introduction? What are the, you know, sensory images that happen as they begin? And write for a set of characters who you don't know who they are. You don't know what they're going to do, but you can probably guess a number of things they might do, especially if you start out by presenting them a clear choice. And that also then gives you the agency that we're talking about.
Yeah, the question is not, will the player character stop the bad guy's plot? Assumedly, they will. But to give the player characters, first of all, access to the plot, as opposed to having to go around and dig it up, and then also give them a choice of tactics so that it doesn't feel like whack-a-mole. It feels like a strategy, or a counter-strategy at least. So do we rescue the princess, or do we go after the necromancer in the graveyard? Do we accumulate good feeling amongst the village so we can turn them against the bad guy? Or do we just burn down all of the bad guy's stored food and hope that the ensuing confusion leads him to make a mistake? So you should be presenting options, either so obvious that the players will think of them, rescue the princess, or ones that you can say sort of gumshoe style. As a ranger, you know that the people of this village could be roused to action, but it will take a heroic example to do so. Or as a ranger, you know that people need food, and if all the food is burned down, then the bad guy has to retrench and do a different thing. Something like that, right?
Right. And so the other side of that, the thing that's easy to slip into, is just sort of, here's a bunch of stuff that happens, and that indicates that the stuff is happening either to the PCs or just they're watching it happen. And then we move to this.
Right.
And so it's also a matter of looking after the transitions so that the players are choosing which scene to activate next. That has another advantage in that by having a choice of things to do next that lead to different other branches, you suddenly have your nonlinear adventure rather than something where you are asking the GM to just cut from this moment to that moment. And here's the next thing that happens. And so it's a very simple, tricky distinction. But if you keep in mind the difference between what happens next, you're going to tend to have things happen to or in front of the players. But if you're thinking, what do the players possibly do next, that gives you your choice and that gives you your next development coming out. And so it also kind of depends on the experience that you're laying in front of people, because one of the things that very popular, experienced, great convention GMs do, and they're running one-shots by definition in this scenario, is they're very good at making you think that you're making choices, while in fact they're railroading the heck out of you, and you like it because of the verve with which that is done. Partly you're embracing the one-shot scenario, partly you want a condensed experience because you're at a convention table and you've got to wrap it up in 3 to 4 hours. So you can get away with this more in a one shot or something that's written for a convention format. But even then, you want to pretty quickly establish a situation and establish a choice and establish again what the player character is doing. How do they describe the situation? And so you arrive in the village and then you describe the village. And then if they decide to walk around talking to people, here's this funny looking guy who has a rake, but he's not using it to rake a field, but instead he's trying to rake the birds out of the trees. So this is a tell that you're putting in front of the players, that you're saying, well, here's a kind of a dark ride situation, but If you then specify they can choose to talk to the guy with the tree rake, which, guess what, they probably will, or they can head off to look at the situation with the cows up on the hill, then you are presenting the players with things to do rather than with things to respond to. And part of that is you start off the beginning of a scene, the indication of something, rather than having everything happen in mid-go, right? So that if you say, well, there's cows up on the hill and they look weird, and a guy with a rake near a tree is being attacked by a bird monster, you are basically saying, and you must react to the bird monster. This is the immediate emergency.
Right.
But if you say, well, you get a weird feeling about the situation with the guy in the tree, and you get a weird feeling with the cows, then the players are deciding what to do and deciding what story to activate. Now, many players, in fact, when you present them with a choice of A or B, will try as much as they can possibly can to do A and B, but that's fine because they're choosing to do it. And if you're especially brilliant, you can think of a way for starting with the cows to have one consequence and starting with the guy with the tree rake have another consequence, and having their choice of which to do first really matter. But even if you don't do that, the players have been presented with the beginnings of scenes that they can choose to jump into rather than scenes already in progress that are essentially coming at them.
And I think some of this also depends on, and I think your convention example speaks to this, the structure of the adventure itself. In a chain of fights structure, you kind of need to have the chain of fights happen, which implies that the most of the things will be what happens to the PCs, because the point of the scenario is that chain of fights in a standard super scenario. And the way to, I guess, change that up is that the first fight in the chain of fights is a defensive battle. Oh no, what is, you know, Mirror Master doing? And then the second chain of fights would be, oh, he's trying to get that orb, and you try and get the orb away from them. And then the third fight, if you didn't get the orb away, then it's another defensive battle, but that's on you because you screwed up Operation Get the Orb. And if he didn't get the orb, then it's an offensive fight where you take the orb and you smash up Mirror Master's headquarters into shards of glittering reflective glass. Then that provides the what the PCs can do, because the fight has given them the option of lose this fight and be thumped on, or win this fight and do the thumping. And in a very narrowly constrained structure like the chain of fights, or like many dungeons, which don't have enough branches and turns to not be basically a chain of fights in many ways, that's the way to present that, is to sort of change up the stakes of the fights and work as hard as you can to make some of the fights things the PCs voluntarily launch on their own hook, as opposed to just going through a door into another room.
Right. So in a chain of fights, the connective tissue between the fights is where the things that they can do to change the conditions of the next fight come into play. And right. In a dungeon, essentially, you know, the reason that structure is still extremely robust and, you know, works well without maintenance is that each door is a thing that the players can do. That door is a thing you can do. You can choose to go through it, and you can choose not to go through it or go down to this next place, but you are deciding what scene to activate by opening, you know, a given door. Now, very often, you have nothing to go on as to why you're opening this door and not that door, but you may feel that you are actively choosing to do things just because you go, well, we're just going to do each door in order. That's how we roll here. Or you make, well, we're going to, you know, listen at each, you know, listening at the door. That's as classic a role-playing thing as possible. And that helps you decide whether you're going to go through that door or not. And so in a dungeon, the linkage between scenes is the corridor or whatever it is that connects the various fight areas. But in an investigative scenario or your typical horror thing, even something where there is players are locked in because they've made a choice, like a pursuit where they're, especially one where they're being pursued. You would think that that is the very height of something happening to you. Someone's chasing you, but the way then to build that into a series of things you can do rather than a thing that is happening to you is present you with choices of where to go next, right? Do you take a train ticket and go to Budapest, or do you head over to your nearest weapons cache, more closer to Prague, for example? And so where do you run to is a classic thing of what you are doing. So even though you're in defensive mode, whether you're it's literally a chase or something else, just because you're in defensive mode doesn't mean that the scenario can't present the players with different choices of activities and responses to being put under pressure. But the way to make sure that that works in the scenario is to, again, be describing not just things that the bad guys can do, but things that the players can do, because that's what's going to be happening at the table, and that's what GMs will need to lock onto. Does that mean that if the players then take a third option, neither Prague nor Budapest, that the scenario goes off the rails? No, you can sort of indicate ways to respond to that, or just make the usual thing. Well, be prepared for players to be unpredictable. And if you have to improvise something, here's the element that you need that will lead to the next scene and keep things going. So you can present very specific choices, imagine scenes that the players can take care of, and also provide indications of how to react when the players take their agency and do something completely surprising with it.
The Prague versus Budapest example also indicates, you know, not just that modern scenarios are harder to write, but also that adventures in which the player characters have more power and ability, it's a rare D&D game that where you can just sort of exchange 90 gold pieces and fly to a whole different city. But a player with teleport, a teleport other, even more important, can pop you to another city with some modest expenditures. So as you get more power to the player characters, the more player characters can do things aside from listen or not listen at the door. And so that is, again, why, you know, when we go back to the originals, why high-level characters are traditionally harder to write for, and high-level dungeons are traditionally kind of bigger messes, because there are so many options that you can do, and it becomes impossible to sort of narrow down all of the choices that a character might make. And so you really do need to then go back to, in order to get to the villain plot, what are the most accessible routes, and put a reason for the player characters to choose those routes into the game, either as a clue or as a non-player character who points to that, or as a, you know, a team of small attacks, you know, one from Prague and one from Budapest, to signpost that those are the choices that you're making going forward. And that's, I guess, you know, it's not a direct scale necessarily, but certainly as the player's characters' resources get bigger, then the amount of what the player characters can do goes up, and therefore your job as the scenario designer becomes more difficult, and it more becomes incumbent on you to channel that power in a direction that will serve the scenario, as opposed to we're going to go to Ibiza and go clubbing and ignore the problem.
Well, I think we've done anything but ignore the problem. I think we've covered the problem in detail, meaning that we must now exercise our ability to do things to head through this commercial and see what hut or segment waits on the other side.
Moving drama.
Hilarious comedy.
And you are the sole protagonist.
Page Turners is my game of personal storytelling for one player and one GM.
Coming in February from Pelgrane Press.
Longtime listeners know Hillfolk, my game of dramatic group play.
Winner of the coveted Diana Jones Award.
Page Turners shifts its dynamic down to the intimate scale of a single main character whose fiction you weave on the fly with one other creator.
Shockingly simple rules keep the focus on emotional interaction.
Extensive guidance helps you shape satisfying outcomes.
Writers Sarah Sam Saltiel, Wade Rocket, and Ruth Tillman join Robin in presenting 11 scenarios spanning a wealth of genres and tones.
Scenarios include
Jazz Age Ambition and Glamour,
A Childhood Haunted by Strife, and A Shadowy Being.
deceit, and survival on the spaceship Earth again.
A stay in Bath takes an unexpected turn in the Austin-inspired Entreaty and Entanglement.
The screwball 30s hijinks of Loose Screws.
The Shakespearean comedy of Love's Loyal Laborers.
A love triangle unfolding from the turbulent 60s to the troubled 20-teens.
Behind the music drama in the LA punk scene.
The arrival of a telepathic stranger on a space-bound way station.
Tragic love between a vampire and a mortal.
And an epic multi-generational saga of artificial beings attempting to build a civilization in the tradition of that extinct species, Homo sapiens.
Gorgeously laid out and illustrated by graphic superstar Jen McCleary.
Whoever you want to be, wherever your imagination takes you.
Whether your journey leads to Union Doom or something harder to define.
Page Turners unleashes your story in new and unexpected ways.
The top secret clearance that you had to undergo in order to listen to this segment indicates that we are once more in the Tradecraft Hut when we talk about the world of spies and espionage. And this time around, I thought we would talk not about a famous spy or even a spy agency, but a famous location, a venue where many espionage adjacent things happened, because it was literally adjacent to a number of things. And that is London's St. Airman's Hotel, which appropriately enough starts off on a bit of a mythic note, Ken.
Yeah, because the first question that one asks when confronted with St. Airman's Hotel, I guess the first question is it a nice hotel? And the answer is yes, it's 4 stars. Is it expensive? It's not cheap, but you know, you could probably afford it if you were saving up. But the question that one asks is, who is St. Airman and why does he have a hotel? What's that about? And apparently there was on the site that is now the hotel from the 10th or maybe the 12th century, there was a chapel dedicated to St. Airman. And St. Airman is either, if you look him up like a normal non-spy fool on Wikipedia, he is a 8th century Frankish abbot with the gift of prophecy. But according to the hotel website, he is actually, that's a code name for Saint Armel, who is a 6th century Breton saint who killed a dragon. And according to the book, A House of Spies, which purports to be a history of Saint Airman's Hotel and spycraft, and I will give you a hint, is not, he was the patron saint of Henry VII Tudor, which again is one of those facts that is only true in books and websites about St. Airman's Hotel, and it's not true anywhere else.
Well, it makes sense for a spy hotel to have a cover identity for its founding saint.
For its saint, who is also given a cover identity. The legend goes that St. Airman appeared to Henry VII Tudor and prevented him from dying in a shipwreck when he was back in France plotting the invasion and conquest of Britain. And in gratitude, he made him his best saint ever and built a chapel to him. And that story is also told of Henry II in a different source. And it is, as far as I can tell, only told in the precincts of the St. Airman's Hotel. So from that promising background, we get to 1889, where St. Airman's mansions are erected on the site. And this is a block of stylish flats, high-end apartments.
And where is this in London?
This is on Caxton Street, right by St. James's Park. So if you're taking the tube, St. James's Park underground station is right, like literally around the corner from the hotel. And so it's at Caxton and Broadway, basically. If that means anything to you, it's in the West End, and it's very, very close, as the rest of the story will demonstrate, to Whitehall and Scotland Yard and the other corridors of power in the British government. So anyway, 1889, Edward T. Hall, a architect who's famous for this and for a department store, built St. Airman's Mansions. It's a lovely red brick Edwardian. Between 1896 and 1899, it's converted into a hotel, as I guess the flats were too small and pokey to be flats. And that is redesigned by the theatrical architect J.P. Briggs, who is credited at least some places, though not his Wikipedia article, for the design of the Savoy Theater. So again, maybe J.P. Briggs is inflating his resume, or maybe someone says, the only thing tourists have heard of is the Savoy, let's pretend that he built that too. Then it sort of toddles along the only high point no doubt being that in 1910, when Aleister Crowley staged the Rites of Eleusis next door in a 6-week program at Caxton Hall, which is a sort of a performance space type area, then it was taken over by the City of London and used as a registry house, which is why tons of stars in the 60s got married there, Roger Moore and Ringo Starr and all kinds of people. But at this point, it's merely a place for Aleister Crowley to flaunt his paganry, which makes it nothing at all like celebrity culture in the 60s. So the very first whisper of intelligence activity that you can ascribe to the hotel comes in World War I, when it is used, like many hotels are, as a hospital for recovering soldiers. And so they would come back from France and they would recover in the hotel. I assume it being a Tony hotel, it was just for officers and the quality. It wasn't for, you know, filthy enlisted men who have to recover in worse hotels somewhere else. And according to a couple of websites, again, no evidence given. What the hell? They say that military intelligence had officers on site to debrief them, which makes sense. A guy comes over from France and you have someone ask them, you know, do they know what unit that attacked you? Do you know any other clues you can give us? That standard debrief happens after combat in all wars and in all professional armies. By 1918, however, it is beloved enough of the Naval Intelligence Department that it is the place that the farewell ball for Room 40, which is the Signals Intelligence Decryption Wing of Naval Intelligence. They hold their big farewell ball at the end of the war in December, and they hold it in the St. Ermin's Ballroom. So by 1918, definitely, and probably you could argue before 1918, the St. Ermin's has done its most important work, which is as a bar near work where government officials can drink and tell stories. And so you can imagine, and you have to imagine, because there, again, no documentary evidence, that the guys in Admiralty House, which is not that close, but it's not super far. Nothing is that far in the West End. They knock off work. They've got a hard day of stopping the Kaiser, and they go down to the Caxton Bar, which is a very nice bar then and now, and they get to drink like gentlemen and lie like sailors and have a great time. And that is, again, after World War I, that was the war to end all wars. Surely we don't need any more spies. But no, in 1924, MI6, or SIS, as it is on its letterhead, moves into the Broadway buildings, which are a building complex. I say complex, it's like a big, you know, street front, just catacorner to the northeast on Broadway, hence the name Broadway Buildings. And so if you go northeast from St. Ermin's, you get to the Caxton Bar, then you get to the Tube Station, then you get to the Broadway Buildings. So literally you can go from MI6 headquarters, you can go through the Tube Station if you suspect you're being tailed, and then you go to the bar instead of do anything else. And that is where British handlers would meet agents and assets, either at the hotel or at the Caxton Bar. The Caxton Bar, by the way, is now the hotel bar, so that's even simpler. But even in the day, they would meet future assets. And there is, again, in the St. Ermin's mythology, that's where Kim Philby was met to be recruited. Philby's autobiography says just it was a Piccadilly hotel. It's not in Piccadilly, but first of all, Kim Philby's a big liar. Second of all, it's more fun to believe that Kim Philby began his career drinking in the Caxton Bar as opposed to anywhere else. And so that then becomes a sort of a, you know, a home away from home, an office that is called, quote unquote, the works canteen, which is what the British term for the office cafeteria or the break room was. We'll go to the works canteen and talk it out. And so the Caxton Bar became, quote unquote, the works canteen for SIS. And eventually the SIS gets big enough that they need to start taking over space in the hotel. And this is in 1938. Where the upstairs from the bar at 2 Caxton Street becomes the headquarters of Section D of MI6. And Section D, D stands for destruction. They are meant to be the guys who work out how to do black propaganda, sabotage, and active measures against Nazi Germany. And maybe, I guess, against the Soviet Union too. But we only talk about the Nazi stuff now. And if they were meant to stop the Soviet Union, they made a great fist of it, because among their first hires are Kim Philby, as I mentioned, and Guy Burgess. So 2/5 of the Cambridge spy ring are hired into Section D. So both Burgess and Philby have offices at Caxton Street, and they would meet their Soviet handlers at the time, this is according to them, in the lobby of the hotel. So they would go out of the bar.
It seems like bad OPSEC, but it is the spy hotel. You can't leave the spy hotel if you're going to do spying.
Right. And also it is Britain, so bad OPSEC was their way of life.
Right.
And they seem to have continued to use St. Ermin's as a drop point for documents and meeting points for handlers as late as, you know, they stayed active, which is until 1951. And so, again, you got St. James's Park right across the way, a very good place to do spy meetups. You've got the tube station, a great place to lose a tail. And what's more comfortable and civilized than meeting in one of the 15 reading rooms, function rooms, or hangout spaces at the St. Ermin's Hotel? It's not a big, sterile lobby like a Hyatt. There's a lot of nooks and crannies where people can go. So it's great fun. In this time also, I suppose we should mention that there is allegedly a tunnel from the hotel to the Houses of Parliament so that members of Parliament who are drinking can race back and get there in time for votes. They still have their, what they call the division bell, which they would ding to let people know the house was being divided. And so they had to run back and take a vote.
Right. And that's if they're the adventurous ones who've gone away from the, I think, several bars in the Parliament building itself.
Right. Yeah.
So, yeah, well, but there's a lot of legislators. You've got to spread them out over a number of bars.
And I feel like if you're a Tory, you can't be seen in a common or government bar. You have to go to a fancy bar. So
right. And this is fancy. It's a beautiful Art Deco interior.
Oh, yeah. It's a lovely interior. As I say, the theatrical redesigner did great work. And so it's a wonderful looking hotel then and now. So anyway, in 1940, Section D becomes the Special Operations Executive of great fame, the Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare, and they actually get assigned to start with three rooms of the hotel as an operational sort of set of offices. They have another entirely different headquarters also in London, by the way. This is not their only headquarters, but one of their headquarters is, as I say, on the fourth floor of the hotel, and then they just slowly start expanding until they have the whole floor taken up. And among the people in their offices at that time is another member of the Cambridge Five, Anthony Blunt. So that's good fun. And they run SOE out of that hotel and out of its other headquarters elsewhere in London and out of Bletchley Park and out of many other places. And so the hotel is actually a government office as well as being a hangout. So that's convenient. The name on the door is Statistical Research Department. So no one can spot the Special Operations Executive. They're too clever for that. And so that also explains why they've got a bunch of sort of middle-aged, clearly not combat-ready people shuffling in and out all the time. They're just statisticians. Pay no attention. After the war, the MI6 document forgery section moves into Artillery Mansions, which is a block south of St. Ermin's. So MI6 is just sprawling all over the whole neighborhood. And George Blake, also a Soviet spy from episode 652, he works at Artillery Mansions, so he must also have drunk in the St. Ermin's bar. 1951, Burgess and McLean defect, and that exposes the Cambridge ring, so a lot of the fun is over. 1961, when George Blake flies home from Lebanon at the request of his employers, they say, oh, don't bother staying with your mom. You're not going to be in London that long. We're going to move you along to your next assignment. We've booked you a room at the St. Ermin's Hotel. And apparently this is a fairly common thing that they would do. So even into the 60s, they're interrogating problem spies in rooms at the St. Ermin's. And I assume that the management is just don't put bloodstains on the carpets. They're authentic. They're period. But everything else is fine. And so that's what they do. And so the house is basically, it's not a safe house per se, but it is definitely used for MI6 activities into the 1960s. But as all things must happen, the great spy era of the hotel ends in 1964 when MI6 moves its headquarters out of Broadway buildings to Century House, which is a comically insecure location in Lambeth. And I didn't bother looking to see if they found a new four-star hotel and picked its bar to commit OPSEC violations in. But the St. Ermin story kind of ends there.
Yes, the other bar is not our topic this week.
Not our topic today. And then at some point, you know, it's been gone through a whole bunch of corporate ownership since 1980. It was, or around 1980. I couldn't find an exact date. It was bought by the Stakis Hotel chain, which is a Scottish hotel chain that sort of expanded. In 1998, it sold to a Chicago holding company. My ears prick up. In 2000, the Chicago company sells them to the Italians. My ears unprick. All the way through, in 2010, it becomes a Marriott because it's bought by a company that manages Marriott's. And they do major renovations to bring it back up to the sort of standard. They take the parking lot out of the old courtyard. And so now it's a courtyard again, much nicer, thanks to Ameramar. And then in 2015, ears prick back up, but not for Chicago reasons, because it is bought by Sunrider, which immediately James Bond is like, you know, sitting right up and saying, oh, hi, that sounds like my brand of vodka.
I've run out of titles for movies. Sunrider. That sounds great.
Sunrider.
Da, da,
da. But as far as we know, and I want to emphasize this, Robin, they're a completely legitimate multi-level marketing herbalist company. So they sell herbal supplements. And have they been accused of adulterating their herbal supplements? Yes, they have. Have they been accused of overstating their medical efficacy? Of course they have. Have they been accused of espionage? Not that I know of. But they are run by a billionaire Taiwanese herbalist named Chen Tai Fu. And again, I've got all the time in the world for Taiwanese billionaires. I think that we need more of them in this world and in Taiwan. But I got to say, you're not shaking the allegations, Chen Tai Fu.
Yeah, there's no record of what his henchman's weird specialty is either.
Exactly. If they can be killed with a fan or something. But anyway, that is the end, as far as I know, of the story of St. Ermin's Hotel. Although one assumes that just for old time's sake, every now and again, Special Branch or someone will sweat a guy in a room of the St. Ermin's Hotel just to keep the old traditions going. Because for goodness sake, it's Britain, Robin. And if they can't do something that was invented in 1924, what can they do?
Right. And so what this tells us is think a little bit about the cool history of the place where the meeting is happening and add a little detail. Just might be a red herring, might matter, but it adds some fun. And you can, with old hotels in particular, you can find images of their interiors and put them up in the Slack channel for your players to look at. And so that's fun. And because it's such a beautiful location, it has been used as a location set for a number of films. None of them spy films. It's never played itself, but it's in Mona Lisa. Its rooftop appears in Sid and Nancy. And there's a bunch of others as well. So, you know, always think about what your location scout is finding for the meeting between the characters and their contact. And on that note, I think it's time for us to remain in London, go backwards in time, and have an unexpected next topic. But first, this exciting commercial message.
Play The King in Yellow has haunted imaginations like a dirge since its first appearance in 1895.
But among the fortune tellers of Europe, the play was not the fearful beginning of something new, but the culmination of something older, The King in Yellow Tarot.
Daniel Harms and John Scott Tyne's famous clairvoyants divined the form's importance of this Carcosan deck.
Painter Kurt Komoda, in a fevered fugue of inspiration, reproduced designs thought long lost.
Spread the cards.
Let the King in Yellow tell your fate.
There is no other who could.
After all, you have seen the yellow sign.
The King in Yellow Tarot is a complete deck of 78 cards in full color.
Sturdy cards with a soothing, silky finish.
Inspired by the works of Robert W. Chambers.
An accompanying 28-page guide explores the history of the deck and recommends, hesitantly, its technique.
A complete PDF of cards and guide comes with your order.
Add to cart at shop.arcdream.com.
That's your reality-shattered cart at shop.arcdream.com. Keep this podcast checked in by joining beloved Patreon backers
Chris Huning,
Christopher Larrick,
Justin Maharab,
Fred Kish,
and Jeremy French.
The smell of frying meat, the jostling of the costermonger, the shouts of the crowd at the sight of a fruit or vegetable tell us that we're still in Britain, but we're also in a British edition of the Food Hut. Or is it, Robin, that we are in a Bermudan edition of the Food Hut that is merely in Britain through chicanery and salesmanship? Because you are here to tell us about something that transfixed you on the anniversary date of April 10th, and apparently has held you tight in its grip ever since, and this would be the 1633 Great Banana Astonishment.
Right, and by transfixed, what we mean here is that the Pelgrains have a social Zoom call every Friday, and I try to come up with a different theme for the Zoom call, and so sometimes I have to resort to On This Date in History websites, and this one has the 1633 Banana Astonishment. So this is an incident that was deemed interesting enough that it will show up on those sites. And it's nice to have something that isn't just like a war or somebody being born or dying. So on April 10th, a crowd gathers to stare at an item hanging in a Holborn shop window. And what it is it's a green banana bunch. And the shop window is the apothecary of Thomas Jotson, who is not just in the apothecary business, but is also a botanist. A few years earlier, he wrote a short book that was the first sort of systematic survey where it was like, let's go through an area in England and catalog all the plants. And he did that in Kent. And that was his first botanical book, or it's a slim volume, apparently. But at any rate, he's so interested in plants that he thought that he would hang a stalk of bananas. And because it included the stock, the bananas turned out to be surprisingly long-lived. So there were multiple bananas shown in the window. They're on a stock, and they ripened from green as they started out on April 10th. They turned yellow in May, and they lasted until June. And according to multiple accounts, enough to go down in history, flocks of Londoners came to gawp at this plant. And Jotson describes it as follows. Each of them has the bigness of a large bean, some 5 inches long and 1.5 inches in breadth. The stalk is short and like one's little finger. They hang with their heads down, but if you turn them up, they look like a boat. The husk is easily removed. The pulp is white, soft, and tender, and ate somewhat like a musk melon. The fruit hereof yieldeth but little nourishment, and hurteth the stomach if too much of it be eaten.
I want to just take a sidebar to say that if someone hung beans the size of bananas in a shop window, we would be astonished today. I mean, yes. The bigness of a large bean, that is a very large bean. I mean, it's a small banana, but if you think about it, that's still big for a bean. It's like a bean the size of a hot dog.
Yes, there. I can't think of any 5-inch beans.
Yeah.
I guess there are some, but certainly none that match the description of a banana. It's not clear that Jotson sold any of them, which would make sense since he wasn't a grocer. He was a druggist.
Yeah. These are not prescription bananas, son. I can't sell them to you.
Right. And so when we started discussing this on the call, first the question is, well, why did he happen to have a whole thing of bananas that was so amazing that it's brought crowds to look in the window for weeks on end? And the answer is somewhat quotidian. It's like, well, he went down to the docks and a ship had arrived from Bermuda. So he bought them. This raises a number of questions that history does not answer, which was, were these the only bananas? Did someone else get bananas but just not display them? Were there many other non-famous bananas who did not go down in history? We don't know, but it is definitely extremely remarkable because regular banana importation to the UK doesn't start for around another 250 years. And that, you know, requires steamships to reliably get fresh bananas to the UK. So how did these fresh bananas get there? How did they survive and still be green when they arrived? So this is why we're starting to feel that maybe something plot hooky is happening here, because this all seems kind of weird. Now, I keep saying banana because it's fun to say, and that's what the
And what history has recorded it as.
Yes. Yeah. But also history always then goes on to say they weren't bananas. They certainly weren't our Cavendish bananas we know today. But since they're from Bermuda, they're probably plantains, which are quite different. And not only were they not Cavendish bananas, which had not been, the cultivar had not been developed yet, they weren't even the first big commercially popular cultivar, the Gros Michel, or as we would say in English, the Big Mike banana.
Big Mike.
Yes, which originated in Southeast Asia, was transported to Martinique, and then eventually grown on a mass scale in Central America. The Big Mike.
These are bigger even than beans. That's how big they were.
They were substantially bigger and deemed more attractive and more marketable and easily transported. But they famously underwent a downfall in the 1920s when a fungus hit them. And that's where the song, Yes, We Have No Bananas, comes from. Is it's about the experience of going to the store looking for Gros Michel bananas and finding that there are none because the supply has been reduced by this disease, this fungus. And in fact, in the 1950s, the fungus finishes them off as a sustainable crop, and then growers switch to the Cavendish. The Cavendish, you will sometimes hear, is also famously vulnerable because it's a monoculture, and they're the result of intense breeding intervention because the original version of bananas are mostly big giant seeds, which are full of big beans, which you can break your teeth on, and they had to be bred so that they no longer have those giant seeds in them. The Cavendish started in Mauritius and was named after William Cavendish, who is the sixth Duke of Devonshire, known as the Bachelor Duke, who is a two-time Lord Chamberlain. And his gardener grew them at Chatsworth in the 1840s. And so that's where the Cavendish is coming.
So we've finally gotten to a greenhouse that can grow bananas after a mere two centuries. Well done, Britain.
Exactly. Yeah. But that, of course, is the, your sidebar on bananas in general. So let's go back to 1633. The interesting thing about this is that this is the year that Thomas Johnson publishes his massively popular update of John George 1597, The Herbal, which if you're typing it in has two L's on the end, which is a big botanical book, a catalog of plants. He adds 800 new species to the previous version, 700 new illustrations, and corrects many errors in the original. And so what I wonder then is, was the banana astonishment a pre-publication book promotion stunt? Because the bananas appear in the book. There's an illustration that depicts dozens of them tightly packed on the stalk. So it looks like there's 3 to 4 dozen of them. And so was the display of the bananas essentially to get people excited about plants and get people excited about Johnson's ideas about plants in order to then later in the year sell the book? That would answer a lot of questions, including why do all of these accounts of these astounding bananas still go down in history? Well, maybe they were planted, so to speak, by Johnson's friends in the press. That's pure speculation on my part, but that's the most logic that I can wring out of this situation.
And I guess before we go too far away from Gerard's Herbal, which you can still buy paperback reprints of or it's online, I should mention that Gerard may have stolen his herbal from a different guy. His preface, he denies intently that he ever did such a thing, which is maybe the wrong place to put that denial, is in the preface that will stay in print for 400 years. Because of the allegations of theft, he couldn't use the illustrations from the guy whose book he did not steal from. And so he had to get different illustrations and then mislabeled the illustrations because he got a bunch of illustrations, but they weren't labeled. And he was not maybe a good enough botanist to know which ones went with which. So if Johnson only relabeled the old illustrations, he was doing the world a great service. And of course, being an herbal, it also includes lots of plants that technically never existed and are magic. So it's full of wonderful things, Johnson's herbal. So the act of adding new things to the herbal is itself a powerfully magical act looked at the very least from the perspective of a 17th century druid. So keep your eyes on a swivel, druids.
Yes, because the point of plants is for healing, and the line between magic and medicine has not been drawn yet, perhaps now disappearing line. And so he had a physics garden in the back of this apothecary where he grew things specifically for their medicinal use. That's the connection between his two avocations. And in the 17th century, apothecary shops were, of course, full of magic components. And so one source describes Johnson's shop as also selling goat bezoars and powdered unicorn horn, or powdered narwhal horn, if you prefer. If the banana astonishment was part of a magical working, obviously that would be phallic in nature. You can't escape that with a banana, even a stock with a whole bunch of bananas. And so that would have been some sort of recognition of the male fertility symbol. And we don't know this didn't happen. It could be that a cultist present in London took part. That would include Robert Flood, who we talked about in episode 591, or the astrologer and almanac author John Booker. His politics, though, were the opposite of Johnson's. So I don't know if they, you know, had a truce drawn in order to take part in this working, or if they were working at cross purposes, because Johnson was a royalist. A decade later, he fights as a colonel in the English Civil War on the side of the royalists. And in fact, he's killed in action in 1644 at the Siege of Basing Castle. John Booker also takes part in the Civil War, making astrological predictions for the parliamentarians. So maybe they're wizardly pals at this point, but they definitely have a breakup and go their own separate ways.
And William Lilly, who I don't think we've done an episode on, the other great astrologer of the era, is just starting astrology in, guess what, 1633. So maybe he walks past the banana and is so astonished that he says, could the stars have predicted this banana? And then rushes home to his sumptuously appointed wife's house to do all the research. So there we go.
Yes. I left him off because he's supposedly in Birmingham at this point, but presumably Boo. News of a banana drew him to London. I think so. Conclude that.
Especially if it's got months to do it.
Yes. And another weird footnote then is that this still isn't the first banana consumed in England, because in 1999, the Museum of London staff announced that they found a banana peel that dates back to the 15th century, and they've unearthed it in the excavation of a Suffolk fish pond. So somehow, even earlier, a banana peel, and presumably the rest of the banana, got there. Surely this wouldn't be you in your time machine who just carelessly discarded a banana peel, but perhaps...
I doubt I would just leave a banana about in Southwark when I'm hanging out with Christopher Marlowe. Like, hey, you think that's pretty good, Christopher Marlowe? Sure, you can call up Mephistopheles, but have you seen a banana?
There you go.
Also, it's much harder to drink Christopher Marlowe under the table than it is some of the guys. So you got to have a banana, you know, in your pocket, or be happy to see them.
Right. Well, you've got to also, when you give him the banana liqueur, you then have to produce a banana in order
to explain what it is that we're enjoying.
Right. And listener, if we've not provided you with enough annoying banana facts to regale recalcitrant listeners with, the final one, I think the best, most annoying banana fact that you can bring up is they're berries. A banana is a berry. And that's one of those facts that once heard, you can't unhear it. And once you've heard it, you can't help but annoy people by sharing with them. So you're welcome, listeners.
So having exchanged our banana astonishment for a banana pontypool, I feel like we have done everything we can to fill this hut with the rich aroma of bananas, which means it's time to scamper away to a refreshing cleansing ad, and then a different corner.
The British are coming!
To the American South and the lands over the mountains in Flagbearer Games' exciting Revolutionary War role-playing game, Nations and Cannons.
Thoroughly researched and beautifully illustrated, in Nations and Cannons you play as spies, skirmishers, and saboteurs in the battle for the future of the 13 colonies.
Cannon Robin listeners can download a free PDF copy of the core rules from nationsandcannons.com using code KENROBIN.
And educators can get a physical copy for use in the classroom absolutely free.
The next book, The American Crisis, Dark and Bloody Ground, follows the actions of the war in the South and the West, with historical adventures, setting information, perfidious new enemies, and a sprawling campaign.
Salvage the rebels' foreign alliances in Haiti and Spanish New Orleans.
Recover a mysterious map from Daniel Boone.
Sail into the heart of darkness, investigating George Rogers Clark's strange conquest of Vincennes.
Escape when all seems lost at Savannah and Charleston.
Fight the guerrilla war alongside the Swamp Fox in a fast-moving hex crawl.
And save the revolution at the climax at York town.
Sign up to be notified of the Kickstarter campaign at yourdadwilllovethis.com. It's time for that most sinister and greasy of corners, the corner that, when we began this podcast, was an obscure corner, but now you find it on nearly everybody's uncle's Facebook page. It's the conspiracy corner. And this time around, we're going to do a little bit of Canadian content by looking at a story that made no darn sense at the time to anyone paying attention to it. And retrospectively, the Fifth Estate, which is sort of our equivalent of 60 Minutes, has gone back and interviewed people and found out what were they thinking, and basically, I guess, sort of accessed the information flowing into the conspiracy pipeline from the Universal Ostrich Farm in Edgewood, BC. And this farm faced a bit of dilemma that is often confronts people who farm birds, which is an outbreak of the H5N1 bird flu virus. And whether you're a chicken or a duck, or in this case, an ostrich, when birds are exposed to this, every authority in the world so far, possibly with coming exceptions, says, well, we got to take a firm hand on this. And the farmer is given instruction. Sorry, you got to call all those birds because it'd be a bad situation if that was allowed to spread. And so in 2024, the Canadian Food Inspection Agency discovers the virus at this farm. And in a normal version of the story, the owners reluctantly comply. They perhaps complain that the government's ostrich replacement fund is slow in coming and full of red tape. But,
and paltry. It's a mere $3,000 an ostrich, Canadian.
Right.
That's not even the eggs of one ostrich for 1 year, I feel.
Right. Well, definitely Canada does have the fees that it gives you. It doesn't index them for inflation. So I don't know when we set our ostrich replacement fee, but arguably not a great thing to happen.
But just part and parcel of doing business as an ostrich farmer, one would assume, unless,
and I guess before I throw it to you for the conspiracy stuff, the reason this matters is that the next most likely virus-related disaster is H5N1 crossing to humans in a big way. If that happens, we're screwed. And in February 25, about the same time that, you know, just a couple months after the CFIA says, hey, your ostriches got to go, a poultry worker in Ohio is hospitalized for H5N1. And so that was an incredibly near miss in terms of that flooding into the population. So these are the real stakes that we're talking here. And Ken, now that we've dealt with the real scary part, let's go to the nutty part.
Right. So 69 of the 400 ostriches had died in mid-January, which is when the CFIA orders the cull. And the owners of the Universal Ostrich Farms refused to cull, claiming that their surviving ostriches were immune to the flu thanks to the powerful immune systems that they had been inculcating into their ostriches. And so then they appealed the decision of the cull, took the CFIA to court, and over the course of the court cases, made the case that these are not just regular ostriches. These are science ostriches that the owners of the OOF had started a company called Struthio Bioscience, Struthio from the Greek word for ostrich, and they were testing and breeding superior antibodies in the ostriches' eggs and meat and such. And they started their fun bioscience project in 2020, which maybe makes you think why they started their fun bioscience project, but amongst their original products was a mask that could blank out COVID with ostrich antibodies. The ostrich antibodies after the pandemic went away are good for obesity and baldness and cholera and celiac disease. Why not?
Right. So longtime listeners will think, here we go. It's the medicine show again. It's the oldest part of conspiracy lipniny bunkum. It's fake cures. So this is part of a long, long history, and one in which, anyone who looks at a headline now can see the extent to which wellness nonsense and conspiracy nonsense have fully merged.
Right. And so amongst the products that they sold was, according to the Fifth Estate, a weight loss supplement more effective than Ozempic called Ostritrim, and a hair growth product that reverses balding called Ostrigrow. And then, according to the Fifth Estate article, Ostrigrow is actually the product of a real ostrich researcher named Tsukamoto Yasuhiro, who is literally the president of a whole university in Japan, has like 1,300 citations in scientific texts, etc., scientific papers. His nickname is Dr. Ostrich, which implies that he is one radiation accident away from being a Marvel villain.
Yes, that's more of his crime-fighting late-night activities right. than his science activities.
Well, you know, who can say what Dr. Ostrich will do? It balances on the point of an ostrich's egg, frankly.
Yes, it's a problem with a superhero ostrich is he just puts his head in the sand when the bank is up.
Yeah, right, and ignores the problem. Anyway, Dr. Ostrich in his university has a ostrich ranch and grows his own ostriches for antibody therapies, and OstraGrow is one of his trademarks. So I'm not sure to what extent the Fifth Estate sorted out, you know, was the UOF a licensed dealer of OstraGrow? Did they steal his trademark? Or what Dr. Tsukamoto said was, we were in preliminary talks that I was going to scale up my ostriches using their ostrich farm. He implied, maybe I have other ostrich farms. I don't need these losers. But in the court case, they misstated his corporate sales. They claimed it was 190 million Canadian, but they're actually under a million Canadian because he's not in the ostrich therapy business. He's in the university running business, really. And also, sort of as a, you know, take that, he says their ostriches have got bird flu. I wouldn't use their ostriches on a bet. So that wasn't very helpful.
Right. And he also explains the idea of the super ostrich is nonsense. He says, an ostrich is an ostrich.
Right. The key is the antibodying, and only I, Dr. Ostrich, can do that. And then he twirled someone else's mustache because he's clean shaven. Anyway, so in the course of the court case, the daughter of the UOF owners went online, because that's where we litigate now, to claim that Big Pharma had ordered the cull to kill off the competition, literally, I guess. So that is in the mix now. But also at court, Struthio claimed that Harvard professor Alessio Fasano was on their scientific advisory board, and apparently the Fifth Estate was the first person to call this guy and say, are you on the scientific advisory board of Struthio? And he says, isn't that Greek for ostrich? I've never heard of those people. And so that didn't help. And then they claimed that the Quebec firm Immune Biosolutions had tested their antibody therapies in 2020 and 2021 and pronounced them revolutionary. And Immune Biosolutions said, no, no, we're too busy manufacturing ephemeral to turn babies into scanners. You have a different company in mind. And we didn't say it. We said your eggs were gross and go away. Get your nasty eggs away from us. We don't want to see them. So it turns out they just lie a lot on official filings.
Right. And they latch on to other people and sort of steal their credibility without right. thinking anyone will look any of this up.
And they went to a fairly high-ranking former politician in Alberta and put him on their board. And then, again, they asked this guy, and he said, the board never met. I just, you know, I get on a lot of boards. I'm the former vice premier of Alberta. That's literally why you become former vice premier of Alberta, is to get put on corporate boards. Finally, it turns out that, I guess, after the, you know, the lockdown and everything, UOF was in big debt. They'd started running out on creditors. They had lawsuits aplenty to recover debts that they owed. So they were in stages of desperation over and above, we're killing all of our ostriches. They were in the, we can't make this ostrich farm pay, we're desperate problems. And so then they said, well, it wasn't Big Pharma that did it, as the case escalated. They said the Canadian government is ordering the cull as a diversion to steal Struthio Biosciences research. And I'm not sure that that's a distinction with a big difference between
right.
Big Pharma is making the Canadians do this. But does Canada have a secret bio research program that I'm not aware of, because it's either secret or Canadian?
No, Ken, we don't have a secret bioscience research. Now, the big difference between those two things is that if you just say Canadian government trying to steal our ostrich secrets, that stops there. Yeah. But if you use the term Big Pharma, put it on social media, a gigantic content-hungry conspiracy ecosystem latches onto that. And so that's what made this go viral. It had people show up to protest the government at the farm, had people visiting the farm, and it brought in all sorts of weird conspirators, such as in May 2025, RFK Jr., who lobbies the Canadian health officials for clemency for the wonder ostriches.
And this is a flip-flop for RFK Jr., because normally if there's a wild or exotic species, he wants it dead and in his car.
Well, who, maybe he just wanted to kill them himself. We'll see.
Right. That's what it was. It's not clemency. He wanted a most dangerous game type situation. And I guess they would be really dangerous if they have bird flu.
Exactly. And, you know, sometimes it's hard to know what he's saying. Maybe he was saying the opposite thing.
Right. He could have, he was being raspy that day because he hadn't had his ostrich antibodies.
Exactly.
His ostrich egg omelet.
Yeah. It's one of the lesser known cures that the ostriches were offering us for his condition that gives him his voice. In July, the UOF hosts a musical event it calls Farm Aid Canada, brackets no relation, I believe is what's up with
brackets
that.
Not a trademark.
I'm sure that that's another case of them just latching onto somebody else's credibility.
Sure, if John Cougar Mellencamp could have been approached for comment, he would have had something unpleasant to say.
Yeah, but someone who's very eager to latch onto this does show up to perform musically, and that's the aptly named Tamara Litch, who is one of the two leaders of the Freedom Convoy conspiracy movement in Canada.
I think Tamara Litch and Dr. Ostrich teamed up in Tales to Astonish 115.
Exactly. Or perhaps fought each other. I don't know which. At any rate, this is months after her conviction for mischief stemming from the Ottawa blockade incident, which people may have heard when their conspiracy-minded truckers basically shut down downtown Ottawa and annoyed the heck out of its residents by doing that. So she comes up and performs musically. I don't recommend this, but you could go to YouTube and find her performance of Proud Mary at Farm Aid Canada in July. Now, this requires from other wellness, nuttiness, and conspiracy circles a raising of the ante. These ostriches are in more and more danger. So in August 2025, the head of Medicaid in the U.S., Dr. Oz, Mehmet Oz, offers to take the ostriches. Now, I don't think, as far as I know, that the Universal Ostrich Farm wants anyone to take their ostriches. I think
That's even worse because America for sure has secret ostrich bioscience research.
If imperialist Americans are coming to take our ostriches, that's a whole other...
I say this because it is impossible to bet against the American government having funded something entirely stupid. So, sure, I'll bet we have an ostrich bioscience program right now being run out of a secret farm in Wyoming or somewhere.
Right. But this apparently is Dr. Oz's own farm that he's offering to take them to. And of course, you can't jump into a controversy like this for a hit of social media juice without having somebody else one-up you. So the next month, the commentator Chris Sanders, who's not to be outdone in offering to spread H5N1 across America, offers to move the ostriches to his ranches in Oklahoma, North Dakota, and Texas. So if you want your ostrich epidemic, listen to that guy. But Ken, that is not what happened in this case, is it?
Oh, no, that is not what happened. What happened is the wheels of Canadian justice finally get to the Supreme Court of Canada, which is, as far as I'm aware, the Supreme Court in Canada. And they said, will you people stop dicking around? Kill all these stupid ostriches already. And so thus it were done in the majesty and process of the law. After $7 million Canadian dollars had been spent on all of this foolishness, the ostriches done been culled, except, of course, for the secret ostriches that were taken to Dr. Ostrich's underground ostrich lair, Dr. Oz's above-ground ostrich lair, funded by the secret U.S. Army ostrich research, and, of course, to the radioactive meteor crater, where one of them will mutate to bite at least Dr. Ostrich and possibly Tamara Litch. But aside from those three sets of magic mutated antibody ostriches, the problem is solved. End of story. And if you can't believe the fifth estate of Canada, whomst, I ask you, can you believe? We'll have no more talk about Big Pharma's secret ostrich plans. Thank you very much.
Right. So it's hard to think of a dumber conspiracy theory than this. But it just goes to show in today's conspiracy ecosystem how slim a thread you need in order to get into the consciousness, at least for a while, and have important U.S. officials chiming in with their dumb ideas. So this clearly cries out to be an esoterrorist situation. Perhaps there's just the level of ambient credulity and scammery gathering at Farm Aid Canada might summon sort of some creature from the outer dark, which
ideally,
of course, is going to possess an ostrich. It's a nice big creature. It has a awesome kicking legs, has an awesome pecking beak. And before you know it, you've got, you know, your monster.
And it's even a reality horror animal because it can bury its head in the sand and change reality around it.
Exactly. So once again, we see that not only are conspiracy theory and wellness scammery have completely merged at this point, but it's all swirling into a dumber and dumber situation. And Ken, I guess we're done this podcast, but surely next week there'll be no nonsense.
No, this will be it will finally return to its grounding as a straight historical commentary podcast with sidelights on game design and simple yet nutritious meals you can prepare at home from ostrich meat and bananas.
Ostrich bananas. So talk to you next week, folks. Stuff having once again been talked about, it's time to thank our sponsors.
Atlas Games.
Pelgrane Press.
Arc Dream.
Flagbearer Games.
Dork Tower.
And Pro Fantasy Software.
Music, as always, is by James Semple.
Audio editing by Rob Borges.
Support our Patreon at patreon.com/KenAndRobin.
Keep this podcast fresh in its shop window alongside such backers as
John Kingdon,
Patrick Joint,
Dan Simons,
Gray St. Quentin,
and Hector Trelane.
Wear this show or drink it from a mug with Ken and Robin merch at kenrobin.dashery.com.
Celebrate your joy of missing out with our latest design, Jomo.
On X, he's at Kenneth Height.
And on Blue Sky, he's robindlaws.bisky.social.
See you next time when, once again, we will talk about stuff.